Once distance is placed between myself and my desire for the inner ring, I was left with a question about why I do what I do. Why continue to write?
Welcome to All About Jack, a feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty, author of The Misquotable C.S. Lewis, and also the author of a study guide to the Screwtape Letters called C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell. On the show today, I'm sharing a talk Dr. Corey Latta gave during the 2018 C.S. Lewis Institute Summer Conference that was held at the Marion E. Wade Center of Wheaton College. Corey transparently shares about challenges mostly related to writing and how the writings of C.S. Lewis has provided insight and encouragement. His advice also applies to those involved in other creative endeavors.
What I'm going to kind of talk about is my journey into freelance and how that parallels some of my understanding of Lewis and what that means for the work I'm currently laboring at. So let me define freelance this way. As I mean it, it's someone unaffiliated with the academy in a tenure track or full-time role. And I can really only get at this biographically. So I graduated with a PhD in English and was majoring on early 20th century British literature, did my dissertation on Lewis, Eliot, and Alden and their theology of time, sort of commonality in their understandings of time. And I get out of my doctoral program and enter into an assistant professor position in English to do what I, dreamed on doing for 10 years or so. No fault of my own, the college closed down around 2 years after I started that role. So that led to me going to another small liberal arts school, and I got a position as a vice president of academics. So still in the academy, not quite the role I envisioned for myself. This is not a role where you're going to get a lot of space to do scholarship, but there I was still in the academy. And then that school, so I'm beginning to detect a trend here, that school goes through financial crisis, and they start cutting pay. And I, at the time, I just had the novelty of my life, as my wife and I have two sets of twins. We had four in under 2 years. So a pay cut wasn't going to cut it. So I was teaching some at my church and end up becoming teaching pastor there. So now my life is teaching pastor at my church. I adjunct around in a couple of schools. I live in Memphis, a couple of colleges teaching literature and theology. And then I try to fund my habit, which is writing and studying Lewis, the imagination, and things like that. So as Frost says in Two Roads Diverge in Wood, you know how way leads to way. I found myself in sort of this spot of kind of being a freelance Lewis scholar. So let me talk about how I first came to Lewis and how that parallels my understanding of Lewis along the tracks of this journey into what I guess we could call freelance scholarship. I first read Lewis in a Tolkien. I was a biblical studies undergrad. And as my senior year, I had one class left to take, and there was a Tolkien class being offered. And this Tolkien class was taught by an English professor. It was really great setup. An English professor who did not think that The Lord of the Rings was high modernist art. And he was co-teaching that class with a Tolkien fanatic who happened to run the bookstore, Mr. Hamer. And he stocked this bookstore for no other reason than his personal love of Lewis. He stocked this bookstore full of, if there was a paperback work by Lewis, Tolkien, or Barfield in publication, in print, it was in that bookstore. So I'm in this class, and he thought that The Lord of the Rings was the highest form of literary art. So they sort of approached this class as kind of a debate. It was really, really fun. So through that class, I get introduced to Lewis and Mere Christianity. Like most people, I was hooked. Mere Christianity becomes Problem of Pain, becomes Miracles, becomes Great Divorce, my all-time favorite Lewis work, becomes his essays, becomes Chronicles, and then on to everything else. So I am a biblical studies major going into seminary at this point. I'm doing New Testament studies degree. And I was working at this during the day and moonlighting with Lewis. He was the guy I sort of ran to. He and Tolkien are the guys I ran to just as a kind of escape and really just to sort of water my soul. Very long story short, I was at a yard sale. I'd read nothing but Lewis, theology and Bible for 6 years. I've got Lewis and Tolkien just sort of teaming up inside me. I'm at a yard sale. There's a biography of Vincent van Gogh and Hemingway's A Farewell to Arms. I am tapped out on Greek. I am tapped out on The New Perspective on Paul. And I just want to escape. So I grabbed these books, 25 cents a piece, read them over the course of the next week. And it was like what was planted in me initially by Lewis and Tolkien was watered with this biography of Vincent van Gogh called Lust for Life by a guy named Irving Stone. Phenomenal. And Hemingway's A Farewell to Arms. And I saw this really interesting thing in Hemingway. Hemingway is maybe the most masterful writer of the 20th century in diagnosing the problem that solution that Lewis would therefore come and give the solution to. If you want to understand the modern condition, particularly the modernist the modernist human condition, read Hemingway. And if you don't see sort of the antithesis to that or the solution to that, go to Lewis or Tolkien. So I was hooked. That began a degree in English, a master's degree, which began led to again way leading to way, led to another degree, PhD in English, and I was full in. Okay. So what began in love, I just wanted to read Lewis because I wanted to read Lewis. I was enchanted by him. I loved the world of the imagination. He captured my reason. What began in love became my professional identity. So a lot of my story is going to involve the way my affections morph over my journey studying Lewis. I enter my first position as assistant professor of English, and I am introduced to the climate, publish or perish. So this is a tenure-track position, all predicated upon publication. Well, what's the one, thing I've been trained for this, and it's my niche at this point, it's my specialization. What's the one thing I'm going to try to publish in? It's going to be Lewis and Tolkien. So then I begin to write articles and book reviews, and my first book is my dissertation on Lewis. And I find myself in the course of Lewis studies growing more cold to the subject. Now, something interesting happens once the college closes. Once I go to the vice president of academics position and it sort of peters out, I find myself left with a new phase in my relationship with Lewis in which I didn't quite know who I was and didn't quite know why I was reading. I had no incentive anymore. I still loved Lewis. It was still there, but it's almost like what was done out of just volitional charity or volitional love or affection became a matter of duty. Professional duty. So I enter this space, which I'm, using today, using the phrase freelance. I enter this sort of space of freelance in which I have to reevaluate what my relationship with Lewis is going to look like. So I want to bring in one of Lewis's essays to kind of talk about this. And I will say this too. One of the kind of disillusioning moments of this transition for me, the thing that I've, 3 or 4 years now into coming out of, is in The Problem of Pain, Lewis says, heaven has nothing that a mercenary soul can desire. I came to find out neither does Lewis studies. That to go to him, you can ultimately, doesn't matter what it is, to do it out of obligation or just professional expectation can, it's not everybody's story, it just happens to be my story, can create a kind of disinterest in the very thing that you are or were most interested in. And you become, I think, what Lewis describes in Experiment Criticisms, you become a user of the text, not a receiver of the text. And that's what I found was happening to me with the Inklings, is I became more of a user than a receiver of what it was they were offering me. So there's an oration that Lewis gave in King's College, 1944, called The Inner Ring. The Inner Ring has become for me a way to sort of understand my journey into Lewis initially, and then into Lewis professionally, and sort of back out of Lewis professionally with the changes in my vocation, and now a new way to sort of enter Lewis again. This oration begins with Lewis saying, I'm going to give you some advice, and I'm going to give you advice about the world in which you're going to live. He says, advice and warnings about things which are so perennial that you can't really call them current affairs. And that advice concerns what he calls the inner ring. And the inner ring is a sort of an invisible social structure, or interpersonal social structure, comprised of spheres in which you are either in or out of. I think that the passage he begins that essay with is this excerpt from Tolstoy's War and Peace. where he talks about a general coming in, or a captain coming in to talk to a general, and the way that the military hierarchy and rank gives a way to or subsides in the face of this interpersonal, unspoken, invisible hierarchy. He says that's a kind of explanation of the inner ring. He says the thing about this inner ring is you are in it from the moment you enter anything, professionally especially, but anytime you enter anything that you have interest in that involves other human beings, there is going to be structures that imitate this inner ring. And your desire to be in that inner ring, he says, is just innate. You just can't escape it. It's a part of who you are. So this essay becomes for me a kind of mantra for and a kind of constitution for what is I experience. He says, in all men's lives at certain points, and in many men's lives at all periods between infancy and extreme old age, one of the most dominant elements is the desire to be inside the local ring and the terror of being left outside. Now, this is exactly what I begin to experience as I enter into the academy and then transition back out of the academy. I felt an intense desire inside myself as I was publishing and writing and studying the very guy I got into for mere affection. I begin to experience this desire to be approved of by my peers and colleagues and superiors inside this invisible social interpersonal structure. Lewis says that all Victorian literature, by the way, is sort of built on this. Like, who could resist the invitation of a duchess? It's this invitation to sort of climb to a higher strata. He says we experience this all the time. Artistic communities are held together by this. You know whether you're in or you're out of an artistic community. And he says, though, the inner ring itself is not evil. The academy is not evil. Artistic community, not evil. A certain socioeconomic echelon, not evil. It's the desire for inclusion in the ring that becomes the problem, not the thing itself. He says the desire to enter the inner ring is a thing entirely unto itself. He writes, let inner rings be an unavoidable and even an innocent feature of life, though certainly not a beautiful one. But what of our longing to enter them, our anguish when we are excluded, and the kind of pleasure we feel when we get in? And he said, the problem's perennial, so let me ask a question of you. And the question he asks of his readers, of us, in this essay is, in the whole of your life as you now remember it, has the desire to be on the right side of that invisible line ever prompted you to any act or word on which, in the cold, small hours of a wakeful night, you can look back with satisfaction? I had come to a place in my Lewis studies in which the answer was a resounding no. Not only had the subject itself, Lewis himself, become somewhat cold to me, professional duty and obligation, but I found in myself a kind of shame, really, for how I was approaching the material. I went from relishing and receiving the work to simply using it for the purposes of advancement. That's the very definition of inner ring. He says, this desire for the inner ring is one of the great factors which go to make up the world as we know it. And he says, unless you take measures to prevent it, this desire is going to be one of the chief motives of your life, from the first day on which you enter your profession until the day when you're too old to care. And he goes on to give two reasons, or two bits of advice and reasons for why he takes the position he takes against this inner ring. One is, he says, we're all potentially scoundrels. Like, we're all sort of scoundrels in the making. It's a very great divorce idea that you are in process all the time. And if you find yourself within certain contexts and certain subcultures, those external forces as well as your internal desire may work together to form you in a kind of egoist. He says, so that is one reason he resists inner rings, is because the potential is always there. He goes on to say, to 9 out of 10 of you, the choice which could lead to scoundrelism will come, when it does come, in no very dramatic colors. He says, in very prosaic moments, we'll be drawn in by the seemingly innocent word, we. Then a progression would occur from that we. And he says, of all passions, the passion for the inner ring is most skillful in making a man who is not yet a very bad man do very bad things. He says, there's a real lure to this idea of we. We Lewis scholars, we Inkling scholars, we at this academy, we in this circle. You take great injury in not being included in that we, and also great pride in being included in that we. That's one reason. The second reason he says that the inner ring is problematic is because the desire itself cannot obtain its object. He says the desire is like a sieve trying to contain water. It just can't do it. It's peeling an onion. You're never going to get to the center of it. It's going to peel itself into oblivion. He says the quest of the inner ring will break your hearts unless you break it. But he says once broken, we'll find in ourselves another desire, and we'll also find in ourselves a new circle, a new ring. And it's going to be the only circle, the only ring that really matters to us. He says, quote, you'll be one of the sound craftsmen, and the other sound craftsmen will know it. This group of craftsmen will no means coincide with the inner ring of the important people or the people in the know. But you're going to find yourself in a new guild, a new fraternity, a new sorority, in which you're brought together in love for a subject, the original reason I got into studying Lewis, love for an author, love for an idea, and it's going to be that mutual love. We all know Lewis's notion of friendship, you know, the what, you two. This mutual love will forge a kind of fellowship. He said, and that becomes the friendship that Aristotle talks about, that rises to the level of virtue. He says it's that friendship that comprises half of the happiness in the world. So, here I am, entered the academy. What was done initially out of love and curiosity and wonder has now become professional obligation. I find in myself this growing sort of, you know, green-eyed desire for inclusion into the inner ring. And then I find myself back out in this world of kind of freelance. So once distance is placed between myself and my desire for the inner ring, I was left with a question about why I do what I do. Why continue to write, seek publishing, things like that, about a subject, about a man, about ideas, without this, you know, sort of dangling carrot of motivation or tenure, things like that. So the question I came to is, you know, my one of motivation, one of heart, and my relationship to the work. Now, let me pull in what, as I was writing C.S. Lewis and the Art of Writing, and when I gave a talk here, actually, and Jerry asked me one question. He said, what's the one thing you really grabbed from this book? And it was a series of letters that Lewis wrote to Greaves in the year 1930 that, combined with Inner Ring, have sort of completed the cycle of this story for me. There is a moment in Greaves' life, you know, Greaves is Lewis's closest friend. There's a moment in Greaves' life in 30 where he is facing incredible literary rejection. And that has produced a very interpersonal, emotional dejection. And Lewis, who has already sort of dipped his toe in the waters of publication and experienced rejection, is comforting him, writing him. There's a series of letters, two or three, in which Lewis is going back and forth with Greaves, trying to get at the motivation for why Greaves writes. When I was prepping this book and came to these letters, it was about as personal and as impactful a thing from Lewis as I have ever read. And it really sort of, along with Inner Ring, really kind of spoke and it gave me a language for understanding what I was experiencing. And I want to kind of share that with you as well. And let this be an on-ramp for how I see my role now, as one more committed to writing about Lewis and the ideas that he so eloquently, you know, produced. I'm more motivated now than I've ever been, largely because of the way he sort of frames this with Greaves. So here's Greaves facing dejection. I'm going to read you sort of excerpts from these letters and kind of provide some commentary on the way. He says one of the first things he says to Greaves is, he says, when you're worried as to whether you'll have to have an operation or whether one is a literary failure, it's best to assume absolutely mercilessly that the worst is true and ask what then. He says, look, this rejection is a bit like an operation, really. An operation is sort of cutting away at your motivation. And it's really asking the question, well, why am I doing this and what's my rank here? Do I have what it takes? He says, just go ahead and start here. Pretend you don't. Like, answer the question, I don't. I don't have all it takes. The worst is true in how I see myself and my relationship to the quality of work I'm doing. Or the motivation, even. And what's in that? And he says, well, what then? Once you start, that's your sort of bottom line, what then? And he goes on to say that the worst turns out to be, in the end, false, and the writer is not an absolutely failure. Well, that's great. Once I've really sort of introspectively dug into myself and realized, well, I'm not quite as bad as I thought I was. I'm, you know, a little bit of a better writer than I thought. That's great. There's hope there. But until the question is ultimately settled, the writer must dismiss the uncertainty of it altogether and persist as if he or she is in fact an absolute literary failure. Like, go ahead and let that filter out your relationship to the work. So what then? Let's say you are. So it goes on to Council Greaves, and he draws from his own personal experience. His collection, Dimer, was rejected by publisher Heinemann. And he says when he read Greaves' letter, he thought back to this moment of rejection. He said, so as soon as I read your letter, I bethought me of myself on the evening when the manuscript of Dimer came back from Heinemann's rejected without a word of criticism or encouragement. And I remember that after a very miserable night, I sat down to assume the worst, as I advise you to do, and on that basis to come to terms with the situation. So the sage wisdom of experience, Lewis, dispels the notion that publication or success dissolves the writer or the writing life's disappointments. And Lewis' successes by this time, he's already achieved a little bit of success with experience in rejection and success. He writes to Greaves and says that even success, like a taste of rejection, but even success won't ultimately satisfy that thing you're searching for. And again, it's sort of the inner ring, the spirit of the inner ring, in a very early form here in this letter from 1930. He says, to you, no doubt, at the moment it seems that to read your own book in print, this is exactly what I experienced when I published my first book, to you, no doubt, at the moment it seems that to read your own book in print and to have it liked by a few friends would be ample bliss. Right, you'd just be completely ecstatic. Whether anyone bought it or not, believe me, author, this is an absolute delusion. Right, there is no inner ring. It might satisfy you for a moment, but very soon, if it didn't sell, my first book did not sell, you would find yourself just as disappointed as you are now. So that in this sense, I'm still as disappointed an author as you. Author's not published, Lewis is. From the age of 16 onwards, I had one single ambition from which I never wavered, in the prosecution of which I spent every ounce I could, on which I really and deliberately staked my whole contentment, and I recognized myself as having unmistakably failed in it. So we've established our bottom line by commercial, professional terms, I'm a literary failure. So then what? So he actually goes on to include, when he did experience this rejection, he wrote a sort of letter to himself in 1926. And in this letter to himself, he works out 13 reasons, major as well as some minor reasons, for why he felt disappointed at his own rejection. Just sort of journaled these reasons as to why he felt the dejection he felt. And they range from a simple desire for personal fame, and he felt the hurt of that, to a desire for a great work of literature, to proving himself that he could call himself a legitimate poet. These are all reasons Lewis charted as possibles for why he felt the hurt he felt. And among his considerations of motive, Lewis comes close to a conclusion. He says, I can really boil these things down to two. And author, I think that's what's going on in you. He says, two elements are at play here. Number one is the desire for some proof to myself that I'm a poet, that I do have what it takes. Number two, the desire that my poethood should be acknowledged even if no one knows that it is mine. He says, but the second reason is a means to the first reason. Like, really, my knowing that I've got what it takes isn't going to mean much unless you know that I've got what it takes. And he says, both desires, that for self-verification and outside acknowledgement, are in essence, he says, quote, manifestations of the single desire for what may be called mental or spiritual rank. Again, a kind of psychological, emotional, spiritual, mental inner ring in which I'm always trying to enter. And look how he parses these motives out, these motivations. He says, the side of me which longs not to write, for one cannot stop us doing that. You're not going to kill the desire that I have just to write. To be approved as a writer is not the side of us that is really worth much. The part of us that wants to reach tenure for the esteem of tenure alone, or wants to enter the inner ring for the sake of being a part of the we. That's not very valuable to us. And depend upon it, unless God has abandoned us, it's really interesting, too, that he's using this language in 1930. You could really sort of see him on the trajectory here toward full Christianity. Unless God has abandoned us, he will find means to cauterize that side somehow or other. If we take the pain well and truly now, and by it forever get over the wish to be distinguished beyond our fellows, well. But if not, we shall get it again in some other form. If we can't learn the lesson, God will keep enrolling us in the class. So all of Greaves' disillusion, the sting of having his work rejected, makes for what Lewis calls a kind of necessary death, a severe mercy, really. into which Lewis implores Greaves to go further. He says, I implore you then, seriously, to regard your present trouble as an opportunity for carrying the dying process a stage further. He says, I implore, because such disappointments, if accepted as death, and therefore the beginning of a new life, are infinitely valuable, but if not, terrible dangers. So about 10 days pass between this letter and another, and Lewis follows up with what he contemplatively conceived of as a nobler, purer motive for writing. And he encourages Greaves to, quote, play himself when he writes, to avoid the pretension of officially regarding himself as an author, and to love the ideas. And I think that's really key. Drop the pretension of becoming an author. Just write. Just do it because you love it. Which will, he says, begin to bubble and simmer. The love for the ideas will begin to bubble and simmer until the writer simply has to write. It's this faithfulness to the creative process that becomes essential to his existence rather than merely beneficial to his success. He says to Greaves, I love these next few quotes. These are the ones I really sort of clung to, still do. He says, I'm sure that some are born to write as trees are born to bear leaves. For these, writing is a necessary mode of their development. If the impulse to write survives the hope of success, then one is among these. You're a natural artist. You're a natural writer. He says, the bee builds its cell and the bird its nest, probably with no knowledge what purpose they will serve. Another sees to that. Nobody knows what the result of your writing or mine will be. But I think we may depend upon it that endless and devoted work on an object to which a man feels seriously impelled will tell somewhere or another, kind of leaf my needle almost, himself or others, in this world or others, will reap a harvest exactly proportional to the output. That there is innate and inherent in the act of creativity itself, in writing itself, in devotion to the ideas itself. There is innate inherent to that its own reward. He says that the writer, like the bee, need not worry about an outcome behind his, beyond his control, then what's the purpose? If I'm not writing to be published, if I'm not writing to impress my peers, if I no longer exist in this inner circle because I've been dispelled or expelled from the we, why do I keep writing? Well, the purpose is to write for writing's own sake. That's what Lewis says. Lewis, by this time, is surrendering. You can see him getting closer to sort of the selflessness of Christianity. And that's beginning to inform his own view of his vocation and his creativity. And he says, and this is just beautiful, the writer's task is to receive God's revelatory beauty for the chief end of reflecting it back to him. So here's what he says. Beauty descends from God into nature, but there it would perish, and does, except when a man appreciates it with worship, and thus, as it were, sends it back to God. So that through his consciousness, what descended ascends again, and the perfect circle is made. So, where does this leave me? Maybe where does it leave you? Well, once out of the sphere of the inner ring, again, the inner ring itself is no evil, it was my desire for it. So once sort of purged and still being purged, it'll always be there for all of us, from this desire of the inner ring, I found in myself an opportunity to forge a new devotion, a new relationship to the ideas, to the work of the ideas. So this kind of space that I find myself in now, I'm a teaching pastor at church and, again, teach college around town and write as much as I can. The space I find myself in now, it's almost like I've rededicated my vows, in a sense, to Lewis and his ideas and the very sort of beauty that I was first drawn to. But this leaves me with, I think, a few challenges and opportunities. One is, apart from the allure of the inner ring, once I've killed the part of me that wants success, and that's a continual putting to death, right? There is an opportunity, a sovereignly appointed space in which I can discern what it is I can write and what it is I need to say about it. Lewis writes this in his letters, it's all over the place, especially after he becomes a Christian, that an idea comes to you and that you must serve it as it comes and that you've got something to say about it that really only you can say, the sort of signature of the soul that bears itself out in creativity. I think about don't know if anybody's familiar with the turn of the 20th century Dutch poet, a guy named Rainer Maria Rilke. His letters to a young poet, if I were stranded on an island, it would be a fight between The Great Divorce and his letters to a young poet. Letters to Young Poets, it's probably the book I've recommended most to people. It's literally just 10 letters. A younger poet, a guy named Xavier Kappas, is about 19 years old. He's in a military academy. He has heard of Rilke. Rilke is a typical 20th century poet, starving and poor, but he's Rilke. And he's only like 26, 27 at the time, but he's revered in literary communities. So, ambitious young wannabe poet writes Rilke and says, just very innocently, the inner ring, hey, take a look at my stuff. Tell me what you think. And Rilke writes him back. He just completely swats away any comments on his. He says, you got some fine stuff in here, I guess. But you've asked me, you've asked others before me, you send your work to editors, you send it to magazines, and I must ask you before anything else to stop and to go inside yourself in the quietness and stillness of your most essential hour. Go inside yourself and ask yourself, must I write? And if the answer is a resounding yes, then you order the necessities of your life around that absolute. It's the same kind of advice that Lewis gives Greaves. And I think, for the most part, the same kind of advice Lewis himself takes as he dares out to write these books that he was, you know, highly criticized for, Chronicles of Narnia and Space Trilogy and things like that. So I think there's an opportunity here for myself, and I think for others, and even, you know, it doesn't matter what context you're in, to sort of reawaken to why I do what I do, right? There's a context here to ask myself, must I write? Answer is a resounding yes, I can't kill that desire. Then what must I write? And to bring myself to bear on it as only I can. Annie Dillard in her writing life has this great, sort of way she begins that book. She says, why do you never find anything written about that idiosyncratic thought you advert to? About your fascination with something no one else understands. She says, because it is up to you. So why did Lewis feel so drawn to and then write about Sinsucht? Because it's up to him. There's something you find interesting for a reason hard to explain. It is hard to explain because you have never read it on any page. You've caught glimpses of it and allusions and things like that. You've never given, no one's ever given a language to it. And it's there that you begin. Dillard says, you were made and set here to give voice to this, your own astonishment. And that, I think, is the scholar, the creatives, the novelists, the poets, the musicians, the artists' ultimate job, to give voice to this kind of astonishment, as only you could give. And this is something, too, this is something that I'm finding more and more, just sort of a side note. I'll frequently sort of talk to other people about book ideas they have, and we'll get to chatting about concepts. A pretty well-known apologist is working on a book right now and just messaged me out of the blue the other day. We're just Facebook friends. We don't know each other. Met once. Messaged me out of the blue and one day said, hey, can I have a phone call with you? I was like, yeah. Said they're working on a book on doubt, and there's a conversation happening between this person's agent and their editor. The agent wants more vulnerability. I want you to really tell your story about doubt here and how it fits into the Christian experience. And the editor wants hardly any of it. It's not what sells. Give me ideas. And as I was talking to this apologist, I thought, look, here's my, she gave me the manuscript, and I thought, here's my experience of it. I can't really get at you because of this sort of smoke screen of things that I know you think you need to say. But this is a fairly personal topic, doubt. And I don't feel like my experience of it is I don't feel like you're bringing your true self to it, and you can't give what you don't have. So you're trying to sort of give something away that I don't think you're really possessing right now because you're out of fear or shame or whatever. You've not really allowed yourself to feel it and then to give it. And it sounds like from your experience that this is something I don't think any other apologist is going to talk about, not in the same way. No one else has your story. So I don't know how helpful the advice was, but it was, I really want, there are apologetic books that are completely propositional. I could read a book about the Kalam cosmological argument or the argument from desire, ontological argument, whatever. But this is a different thing, and it seems like only your voice can carry this. And the last thing I would want to experience in reading this book would be you trying to parroting another voice, that this is something that you must do. And it seems like that the reason you're not doing it is because you fear it not being successful. So this is something I think is really important and something we lose, and I think really at the heart of what Lewis was telling Greaves. Another takeaway is, and I'll probably try to off-ramp with this, there's a phrase that Lewis subscribes to it, Tolkien subscribes to it, Charles Williams subscribes to it, Dorothy Sayers really was one of the first people I came across to really give it language, and Madeline Lingle has since done that. But there's a phrase that's helped me and continues to help me, and I think it's my sort of my bedrock for why I write and how I write and motivation, and it's the phrase serve the work. Probably familiar with that, to serve the work. Madeline Lingle says it maybe most eloquently in her Walking on Water, which is a wonderful book about kind of the emergence, kind of convergence of Christ and creativity. She says, if the work comes to an artist, Lewis also uses this idea about creativity too, that the idea comes to you. Most all writers do. When they write about writing, they always talk about the idea coming to you. But if the work comes to the artist and says, here I am, serve me, then the job of the artist, great or small, is to serve. The amount of the artist's talent is not what it is not what it is about. It's Lewis talking to grief. So what? Maybe you're a literary failure. Has nothing to do with this in your process. John Reyes says to an interviewer in the Paris Review, Lingle says, listen to me. All of writing is a huge lake. There are great rivers that feed the lake, like Tolstoy and Dostoevsky, and there are mere trickles, like John Reyes. All that matters is feeding the lake. I don't matter. The lake matters. You must keep feeding the lake. Serve the work. And then decades before, in one of her letters, as she's sort of corresponding about Mind of the Maker, Dorothy Sayers says, the first Christian duty of man as man is to serve God. But his first duty as a worker, as a creative, is to serve his work. Since this is the only means by which his work can be made to serve God. Sort of serve the work. Not serve the success or the accolades or the, you know, the pats on the back, or even concern yourself with the criticism that the work may bring, but to serve the work because the work is given to you by God. So I'll say just a few words about what I'm working on now and how, and this kind of, by the way, another Lingle work I just thought about. If you've not read Circle of Quiet, part of her kind of published journals, really, Lingle, it's phenomenal. It's exactly what we're talking about. So Lingle publishes A Wrinkle in Time, hugely famous, and then goes through, and this doesn't really happen much. Usually once you've hit fame, even if no other book is as good as that first book, you can kind of ride that fame for a while. She goes through a decade of around 10 years of rejection and really sinks into some, you know, fairly substantial depression. And one of the books that she writes about this in is A Circle of Quiet. And it's this little geographical space close to her home. And she talks about this place, the Circle of Quiet, as a space in which she can kind of recenter herself on the work. Not herself on the work, but the work itself. So if you're not, anyway, that's kind of a book plug. If you haven't read Circle of Quiet, it's phenomenal. So this was a book I was afraid to write. Really, it just was too ambitious or bold, I think, when I was in the academy as a tenure track professor, and now I feel all the liberty in the world to write it because I just want to write it. I don't really care. It was a book on the imagination, which is still happening, but from that book, there are two things. One is a book on the imagination and the apologetic of the imagination. The premise, I guess you could say, is there are atheist authors, but there are no atheist stories. That as soon as, doesn't matter who you are, I mean, Stephen King, Philip Pullman, I don't know where King is in his faith. But Philip Pullman, William Burroughs, Hunter S. Thompson. I'm an early 20th century modernist, so all my guys, Pound, Hemingway, D.H. Lawrence, you know, these are folks who, if they were going to bring the divine into the mundane, it was going to be to lower the divine, not to exalt it. But you have this problem in storytelling that seeks to exclude the divine, as Hemingway so often tries to do, or Frost, or any of these guys. As soon as I populate a fictional world with fictional characters who operate on the principle of universal truth, I am creating a world without ground. What does a character mean when he says love? Why would a character act virtuously? Why do we see all these universal themes told again and again and again and again and again? It would seem that if you are an atheist author, and atheists have tried to do this, Philip Pullman, his sort of young adult trilogy, his Dark Materials, is explicitly written for this reason, to kind of counter Tolkien and Lewis. You would think that an atheist author would be successful in creating a world in which there's no trace of the divine, right? Doesn't happen. Can't happen. As soon as I come across any kind of virtue, I'm called back on, or called, sort of called to the question, thrown back on the question of, well, what does this virtue mean and where did it come from? You're sort of playing with loaded die. I can't, change the word. And you see this in Hemingway. I can't change the word love or hope or transgression or things like that. Hemingway's got a great story, A Clean, Well-Lighted Place, in which there's a suicide. He's a failed suicide, and he's sitting at a cafe. And I think this all intersects with Lewis and Tolkien and their projects at the time as well, really, really beautifully. But the suicide is sitting at a cafe. It's like 4 in the morning. And there's a younger waiter and an older waiter. You guys read this short story, Clean, Well-Lighted Place? Phenomenal. And this younger waiter just wants to get home. Hey, man, this guy, he's deaf as well. Step suicide, just go to a bar. And the older waiter says, look, it's not the same thing. We need clean, well-lit places. And then the sort of failed suicide drunk ends up leaving, and the old waiter goes home, and he makes his way to a bar. And in this bar, he's drinking, and he begins to fumble through the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, nada, 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 who art nada, blessed be by nada, nada. And you read that story and just come away with the question, why put that in there at all? Well, if you're Hemingway, why in the world would you even have that scene? And I don't think it's just to make fun of, because this is a guy who believes in universal truths. We need certain things. We need light and space and, you know, hope. It's because for Hemingway, the answer is always there, just can't grab it, but it is there. And it's my bringing into this fictional world desire, longing, and love, and hope, and empathy, and things like that, that ultimately become the fingers that grasp for the meaning that I can't, if you're Hemingway, I can't quite, you know, grasp. But the presence of itself suggests something far beyond the human or the social, the biological. So the Book of the Imagination, I'm going to bring a lot of inkling thought into that and argue that you can have atheist authors, but you cannot have atheist works of art, can't have atheist fiction. That is a kind of, almost like Lewis's moral argument, it is a kind of artistic argument necessitating a God. And the other one that I feel really free in doing, I'm almost done with it, and I really have a lot of fear about this book, because I think it might be just a train wreck, because it's so me. It's a book on Christ and creativity, and I got to thinking about Lingle's Walking on Water, and what it means for me to be a Christian, or you to be a Christian, and to create. And I don't know of many good works that really bring enough, they don't insert the theology deep enough into the creative process. So I'll say a word about this and I'll end. The best work I've ever read is Dorothy Sayers' Mind of the Maker. I mean, that is the book on what it means to be a Christian and to create. Powerful. Creative idea, creative energy or activity, and creative power, right? Sort of trying and reflected in the artistic act. But there's not a whole lot of advice about the actual act of creating, or not a lot of reflection on the more granular aspects of creating in that work. It sort of operates at a certain level, a very brilliant and needed level. So I got to think about what it means to be a Christian and to create, and heavily inspired by Sayers. And I thought, really, all of creativity, any act of creation is really three-part. It's really, I think, submission, rejection, and acceptance. And I think it patterns the contours of the incarnation itself. That creativity always begins with submission. Now, that happens at a couple of different levels. I submit myself to the idea first. The idea comes to me, as we've heard from Lewis and Sayers and these folks. And I have a choice there. I can kind of leave it at the door as it knocks, or I can invite it in. And once I invite it in, I've got to give myself to it. So an idea comes to me, I must submit myself to it. But then I must submit that idea to the world. And this, of course, is the first stage of the incarnation. The Logos submitted, given, Emmanuel with us, for us, to us. Bonhoeffer talks about Christ pro me, for me. I don't just sort of sit on these ideas. I give them out. So there's an act of submission and creativity, invariably. But then, and this also patterns the contours of the story of Christ, the incarnation, and it always patterns, if you're a creative who submitted anything, you know this to be true. That submission is always met on one level or another, eventually, with what? Rejection. He came into his own did not receive him. That is perfectly analogous to the, it's exactly what Greaves was facing, exactly what Lewis faced. It's perfectly analogous to the creative act. I will be met with rejection, which is a kind of dying so there might be life. And there's a real beauty to this. We hate it. We don't want any part of it. I start that chapter with some of the stories of rejection that our most famous authors have experienced. Thomas Wolfe and T.H. White, and I mean, it's unbelievable. Dickinson, some of her stuff, just glorious rejection. I mean, like harsh, soul-sucking rejection. And yet, it's this rejection that forges in them, and I think it's exactly what Lewis is talking about to Greaves, and he was talking about in a ring, it forges in them an ambition or motivation of pure substance. That once faced with rejection, I have to go inside myself and ask what Rilke tells Kappas to ask of himself, must I do this? And if the answer is yes, I will order the necessities of my life around this absolute, regardless of the criticism, whatever else. And Rilke faced his own share of criticism and rejection. So in that rejection, I met with this third thing. This is Philippians 2, I think. Rejected by man only to be exalted, submitted. So Philippians 2 has all this. Had the mind that is in Christ. What is that? He did not consider equality with God something to be grasped, submitted himself, emptied himself, met with rejection unto acceptance. I don't necessarily find that my work is going to be accepted. I hope it is. I hope the book is published. I hope the article is accepted. What I find, and this is far more important, far more foundational, is I accept my role as one who must serve the work. I accept my role as one who's ultimately approved of by God, whose call on my life is in itself a kind of approval. Sort of Matthew 3:17 hovers over the entire creative act for the creative. This is my son whom I'm well pleased, that he delights in what you do, delights in who I am, and therefore what I do, particularly if I'm serving the work that he's given me. And there's a deeper level of acceptance there that really brings me then back to submission. Once I have brought my full self to myself, to you, to God, then I'm more free to bring my full self to the creative process, which will, as Lewis says, bubble and simmer and cause me to express it again, submit it again. So that's the book I'm working on. I'm going to call that book Serve the Work, Stray Thoughts on Christ and Creativity. Emphasis on stray, because the book is basically if you ever read like Marcus Aurelius, like axiom, axiom, aphorism, aphorism, that's kind of where it is. That's it.
You've been listening to All About Jack, a feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty. Be sure to check the show notes for any links mentioned today. You can get those notes either at EssentialCSLewis.com and look for this show, but it might be just as easy to locate the notes where the audio files are hosted at allaboutjack.podbean.com. Again, that's allaboutjack.podbean.com. Podbean is spelled P-O-D-B-E-A-N. At either location, you can find various podcast shows with interviews to authors of books about Lewis, an occasional series about a specific Lewis essay, or a special series on Why Read Lewis, and many other podcasts. You can also listen to All About Jack via iTunes. If you don't know how to do that, then check the show notes for a direct link to that, and consider rating my show there on iTunes. Before ending, let me remind you about two books I've published. The most recent is The Misquotable C.S. Lewis. It explores 75 questionable quotations and why you shouldn't share Lewis quotes unless you know he really wrote it. I also reveal the closest things Lewis said related to the questionable sayings I examine. I've also written an enhanced study guide to the Screwtape Letters that's called C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell. You can learn more about that book by visiting ScrewtapeCompanion.com. There you can get an immediate download of a free 20-page PDF sample of the book. Again, that's ScrewtapeCompanion.com. Purchasing either of my books is a great way to indirectly support this podcast and make sure it remains freely available. Again, thank you for listening to All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty.